Okay, folks, you are listening to the latest episode, the latest chapter, and, you know, on a remarkably fine Good Friday, I have to say a very happy Easter to the Rock Chick writer extraordinaire, Ms. Leslie Ann Jones. Ms. Jones, are you looking forward to this break, which for most of us is a holiday, but for which you, of course, is a pillar of your great faith?
Oh, thank you, Michael. That's nice of you to flag that up. Yes, it's obviously Easter time. It's the oldest and most important festival in the Christian Church.
Christmas Day?
Well, absolutely, because we celebrate the resurrection of Christ, without which we would not have a Christian faith.
Right, I see, yes.
It is the most important thing. And people often ask why the date varies, why the Easter date varies in the calendar, because it's a different date every year. So I thought I would just give a little background to this.
Please, yes, please, I want the religious lecture.
No, it's not a religious lecture. Right. It's just the date varies in the Western Church. It's different in the Eastern Orthodox Church, the Greek Orthodox and so on. But here in the West, between the 21st of March and the 25th of April, on the first Sunday after the first full moon, following the northern spring equinox, which is the first day of spring, that's when we have our Easter. Right. So in the New Testament, you will find that the resurrection is said to have occurred 3 days after Jesus was crucified by the Romans and died in about 30 AD. We don't know the exact date.
Right. Okay.
So that's the background to Easter. I think people tend to overlook the Easter festival. And yes, as you say, they do celebrate Christmas. I think that's more of a cultural thing, more of a social thing. But certainly in religious terms, Easter is much more important.
Yeah, well, I'll take your word for it. For me, Easter's always been about fish on Friday. My dad always insisted we had fish on Good Friday. You know, it's a sort of Merseyside thing, really. You know, the mixture of sort of Protestant and Catholic religions and that sort of thing. And Easter eggs, which I loved. Easter Sunday, big, you know, going out and getting lashed on the booze at some family event. Easter Saturday is always great to watch your football match between Good Friday and Easter Sunday. And then Easter Monday, again, another sort of, you know, bank holiday beano. I love bank holidays, actually, because all my life, and I think you're probably the same, I've put myself under, you know, pretty intense pressure in my job because I want to succeed and do it properly and get it right and work long hours. And I do like the relaxation of a bank holiday because it doesn't make me feel guilty for perhaps not doing something that day.
It's a bit of a ritual in this country, isn't it? But yeah. I think for the vast majority of people, the Easter weekend, the long bank holiday weekend, as you say, has nothing to do with religion, is it?
No, nothing to do with religion at all. And yet, to me, it's the religious images are much more graphic, as you quite rightly say, than Christmas. Christmas is about a little baby in a manger. And unfortunately, Easter is all about Jesus on the cross, isn't it? You know, those are the images of the two and all that kind of stuff. Anyway, to move on from religion to other matters, this lady, Jennifer Akuri, I mean, she's becoming a bit of a broken record, isn't she? I've read 5 times now that she's first revealed the secrets of her relationship with Boris Johnson, the latest one being in the Daily Mirror this week over 4 days. I mean, I'm getting a bit fed up with it.
What is she trying to achieve? I mean, she is the embodiment of hell hath no fury like a woman scorned, isn't she?
Yes.
I'm not sure what she's trying to do here. She's obviously being paid for her revelations in various newspapers.
Absolutely.
So she's made a little bit of money, but there's not huge money in that kind of
expose anymore, right?
These days. There was a time when we would have paid 100 grand for something like that.
Yeah.
She'll be lucky to have got, what would you say, max about 5 grand?
Absolutely. I was going to say she'd been lucky to get 20. She might have got it over a few days or something like that. But no, I totally agree. But she does genuinely seem to be the woman scorned. You know, she seems to be perplexed and amazed that Boris Johnson has now ghosted her, for want of a better word, or written her out of his life. But what she doesn't understand is when somebody becomes the prime minister and when somebody in America becomes the president, you have to ghost people for security reasons, for you know, national security, for your own security. It happens all the time. Important people have to isolate themselves.
She didn't want to be rubbed out, did she? The telling photograph was the selfie in Boris's kitchen just before his wife Marina came home from work. I mean, oh dear God. I looked at that and thought, oh no. And there's the two glasses of red wine on the counter. And it just, it smacked of dishonesty and just the lowest of the low, really. I mean, we know that Boris wasn't faithful to his wife.
Yes.
But in some ways, this kind of expose shouldn't be allowed. Why are the newspapers trying to embarrass our prime minister in this way? Why wouldn't they just tell her to go away?
I totally agree with you. And also, what about her role in breaking up marriages? She can say, oh, well, no, he was a multiple philanderer. Well, how does she know that? How does she know that her involvement in Boris Johnson's life didn't lead up to the breakup of his marriage, you know, with the despair of his four children all taken into account? I think,
or however many children he's got.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, but I mean, the married children with Marina, you know. And I think it's, I think it's pathetic, honestly. But you are right. I don't know. Boris seems to get hounded, you know, by papers from both sides of the political spectrum. The Daily Mail are always after him, you know, saying he's been spending illegal money on decorating Downing Street and all that. I just don't get it, because everything that anybody uses to try and attack Boris Johnson generally doesn't stick, does it?
And it doesn't look good on the world stage, does it?
No, it doesn't. You know, I agree.
To promote our prime minister as a shagger is not a good look.
No.
So why don't everybody shut up? Why don't they just all give him a break and let him get on with the job?
Yeah.
This isn't going to do anybody any favours.
No, I totally agree with you. Absolutely. Talking about big shaggers, by the way, this week Warren Beatty was 84. I can't really imagine Warren Beatty at 84, because Warren Beatty is one of the most handsome men ever to come out of Hollywood, wasn't he? You know, he had strings and strings of girlfriends, and I don't want to see a picture of him at 84. Do you know what I mean?
I do know what you mean. I've never understood the attraction, really. If somebody has a reputation as being a big shagger, that's the last person I want to go anywhere near. Because, really? Because, look, they're not going to be in it for the relationship or for the long term.
Yeah.
They're just making notches on the bedpost. And I think it's with these guys, it's so often about the reputation rather than the man. People think there must be something in it, so they run with it. But, you know, how good is the guy going to be, really?
Yeah, well, no, I totally agree. The best line I've ever read about Warren Beatty was that when he was in his sort of, you know, 20s and early 30s, any time he answered the phone, any time of day or night, he would always adopt a very heavy breathing policy, like, what do you want? And what he was trying to do was, he admitted later, was give the impression that 24 hours a day he was screwing some Hollywood starlet, you know, one after the other, and they'd be queuing up outside his house for his services.
As if you'd answer the phone when you're on the job, you know?
Yeah, but I think he was trying to make out that, you know, he was at it so incessantly that there was never any time for him to answer the phone when he wasn't having sex with somebody.
How insecure is that?
Well, very insecure. At least George Best, with all the mega shagging he did, he didn't do it to try and impress anybody. He actually liked the opposite sex. He liked sex. He said on that very famous Terry Wogan show, when he was pissed out of his head because they'd left him in the green room on his own for 2 hours with six bottles of wine.
Mistake.
Yeah, that's right. And he said, I like screwing, Terry. Yeah, it's all right to say that. I like screwing. But he admitted he couldn't remember the names or even what the girls looked like for half the women that he had sex with.
Well, that's horrible, isn't it? I mean,
on
both counts. It's horrible for him and it's horrible for the women he was involved with.
Yes.
Well, I mean, what are you saying? That there are females in the world who just want to have sex with George Best or whoever it is, just so that they can go around saying, I had sex with George Best. Well, I mean, it's a bit shallow, isn't it?
Well, shallow, but also they want to say, well, I wonder what all the fuss is about with George Best. You know what I mean? And might decide it's something they've just got to find out. But anyway, talking about that, your big friend, your great friend Liz Jones, is on the front of the Daily Mail this week talking about sex, over 60, best of my life. Do I really want to know that about the other Miss Jones?
Well, I don't think we do we? I absolutely adore Liz Jones. I'm very fond of her. She's a great girl.
Yeah.
She, you know, she speaks for women of a certain age, and good luck to her. But I think there is such a thing as too much information. And I think on this occasion, we've crossed that line, haven't we? I just find it a little bit undignified, I'm afraid to say.
Yeah. At the same time, I don't want to make out that, I cringe at the idea of wrinklies having sex. Because, I mean, people still want to have sex at that age. Fair enough. But you quite rightly say too much information. Now, some information we've come across since we last broadcast, Ms. Jones, is that the Archbishop of Canterbury has now officially confirmed there was no marriage going on 3 days before the public ceremony, and it didn't happen in the backyard, and he didn't marry Meghan and Harry, which, of course, leads us to the conclusion that if that wasn't true when she was talking in her opera interview, what else wasn't true? And does that validate what Piers Morgan said himself, which he would not retract, and for which he stood down?
It's looking good for Piers, isn't it, I have to say. But I mean, I think everybody has misinterpreted this. The Archbishop has also said that he declines to comment on what did happen in the back garden that day.
And he's made it very clear he didn't hold a wedding ceremony.
Well, of course. Yeah. But I think, I feel it's just a misinterpretation of terms here.
A blessing or something. Yeah.
I believe that he conducted a blessing, a private blessing, which lots of people go for, especially in cases where, say, for example, in the real world, you can't get married in church if one of you is divorced, yeah. Or both of you are divorced, and the former spouse is still alive. But you can have a blessing in a church service.
Yeah. Yeah.
So you can do that, and you can go and have a civil marriage in a town hall or wherever,
sure,
or a venue of your choice. And I suspect that Meghan, I'm no defender of Meghan, as you well know,
yeah,
but I suspect that she misinterpreted the terminology.
Yes,
and
she
misunderstood marriage and marriage blessing.
Yeah.
And no. I don't feel that she's done anything wrong here.
No,
I think the papers just took it all out of context and blew it up.
Yeah, I think that might be right. But at the same time, I think it illustrates a level of rambling and a level of, you know, trying to sort of get back at the royal family type thing. But anyway, look, enough of that. Back to Piers. I mean, I see two or three stories a week now about the dilemma that ITV have got and Good Morning Britain have got in trying to forge a presenting team that can have anything like the impact of Piers and Susanna, and they keep hitting brick walls.
They can't do it, can they? So they've now said that Susanna will be the anchor of the programme,
yeah,
and that there will be a revolving scenario of not exactly co-hosts, but guest hosts,
yes,
coming in to assist her.
Yeah.
But she will be the focal point. And I think they've probably shelled out quite a lot of dosh to hang on to her, because she could easily have walked as well.
Well, she could have, but I mean, that would have blown her career up. Whereas for Piers to have initiated it, I think, you know, puts him in the driving seat. I would not rule out Piers returning, okay?
Oh, I would, absolutely. He's not going back. And he has said that, I'm never going back. But he could take her with him to his next gig.
Well, what I'm saying is this. I was once in that position. Have I told you the story about me and Alan Brazil at Talk Sport when I had to sack him?
Yes.
Yeah, yeah. Well, just to refresh the memory of our listeners, they've heard the story many times. We went to Cheltenham for the races. Al didn't get back for the Friday morning show. And the management at the time said he's got to go. And I had the unfortunate duty of having to tell Al that was what we were doing. A month later, when our figures had collapsed, I mean, literally collapsed on the breakfast show, I did the breakfast show with him. I couldn't find anybody else to bring in with half the personality or the attraction or the style of Alan Brazil. Our figures collapsed. The commercial department started banging their fists on the table. Where was the money going to come from? Now people didn't want to buy adverts and all that. I had to go and find Al in a wine bar in the city of London, right, and get him back. And of course, Al is a very savvy guy. And the moment I sat down and said, look, Al, I've got some great, great news for you. You know, I've managed to convince them that you've got to come back. He just said to me, OK, how much? And we had to double his money to get him back.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Mm. Well, understandable. But he played that to his own advantage, didn't he?
Yes.
But I feel that there, I mean, Piers has said that Susanna didn't talk to him after he stormed out.
Yeah.
Mm. I feel that there's more going on under the surface here, and that we know he's going to end up on another breakfast type program, maybe, yeah, more newsy, but it could well be that they're angling to take Susanna along as well.
Well, I don't think she's vital to Piers in any way. I mean, yes, okay, they had a, you know, they rubbed against each other. She was, you know, sort of centre left, and Piers was sometimes centre right, and that sort of thing. But I didn't think she was absolutely vital. I liked Suzanne Lerotte, great presenter, but, you know, without doubt, the star of the show was Piers. But do you know there's half a dozen petitions now going around, all demanding that Piers returns? I just think pressure will grow. I think pressure will grow because they've commercially shot themselves in the foot. The share price has gone down. You know, the whole thing looks smashed to bits at the moment with no sort of continuity and no sort of shape. So I think there's a chance he could.
He's not going back. Well, put money on it. Let's have a bet. How much do you want?
I bet you £50.
Okay, yeah. Done. Okay. Shake your hand, 50 quid.
Okay, all right, fine, no problem at all. Right, now then, Ms. Jones, you will remember in our last podcast, I said that I never wear anything red, okay? Mm-hmm. And you agreed with me and you said red's not your colour either. Now, of course, I'm being sent loads of pictures of myself in a Manchester United shirt, which, of course, is red, scoring a famous penalty goal at Old Trafford. So I have to hold my hands up. That's the one and only time in my life I wore red. But the thing is, it was a sponsored penalty kicking competition, right? And you had to wear the United shirt because the whole thing was being sponsored by Vodafone, I think it was, who were the United sponsors at the time, and their name was on the shirt. So that's my story and I'm sticking to it.
Well, you didn't have any choice because that's the team strip. You know, if it's that colour, you've got to wear it, isn't it? You can't be signed to Man U and then go to the team coach and say, sorry, but red doesn't suit me. I don't think I want to wear this shirt. Well, they'd show you the door, wouldn't they?
Well, you're absolutely right. I mean, the point is that, of course, I've been a lifelong Evertonian. Now, I got so much stick afterwards from Everton fans putting on a United shirt, but I said that to them. I said, look, I asked if I could wear an Everton shirt, and they said no. Vodafone are the sponsors. It's their shirt you've got to wear, and so I had to. But I did get a lot of grief about it over the years. I won the penalty competition, by the way, and I have my silver dish in my studio office here as a reminder of those great days. I have some great news for you, Ms. Jones.
Throw it at me. I need some good news.
Okay. Well, drink 6 glasses of wine a week and you'll never get cataract problem. That's a nice incentive to start glugging the vino every day, isn't it?
Well, how did they work that one out?
Well, I know some latest survey we've seen that if you drink a glass of wine a day or 6 glasses of wine a week, you can save your eyesight. The fact that you
maybe it's because you won't be able to see the fridge any longer to get any more wine out.
Yeah, no, that could be true. And of course, they don't say how much damage that would do to your liver. However, if we go back to our heydays in Fleet Street, I mean, 6 glasses of wine a week is ludicrous.
A sissy, isn't it? I mean, 6 glasses of wine an hour was more like it.
Well, I was going to be moderate about it and say 6 glasses of wine a day more like, you know, with a couple of pints and some champagne thrown in. Fine, but...
How many glasses in a bottle is? It's about 5 or 6, isn't it?
No, it's 3 large ones. So if you go in,
3 large ones.
Yeah, 3 large ones. So come on, Miss Jones. You know the double entendre, please. Family show.
It's a family show. Yeah. Come on. But no, I thought a standard pub-sized wine glass. Yeah. You could get about 6 glasses of wine out of a bottle.
Yes, you can. If that's 1, 2, 5. I know all these because I'm an expert on it. Okay. So if you ask for a large glass of wine, as I always do, because a small glass doesn't last me long enough, you are getting 250 centilitres, okay? And a bottle of wine contains 750 centilitres of wine, so you get 3 large glasses. However, a small glass, you're absolutely right, 1, 2, 5 centilitres, you get 6 glasses, okay? However, I never drink small glasses, so if I drank 6 glasses of wine a day, it would be 2 bottles, which is very excessive. But we used to do that all the time, didn't we? I mean, it just never stopped.
What I was about to say was that, you know, we'd go over the wine press or wherever we were working at lunchtime. Everyone would have a bottle each.
Yes, that's right.
And then it would be back over the wine press after work. Well, actually, there was never any such thing as after work because we were always working around the clock. And if that's a story cropped up in the middle of the night, you'd jump out of bed and you'd go, wouldn't you? So you're always
of
working.
Of course you
And then go and have breakfast in the meat market at Smithfield with all the, what do they call those guys? The meat luggers.
Are they meat porters?
meat porters.
Yeah,
that's
right.
So you'd go and have breakfast and probably another pint of beer in the morning.
Yeah,
I mean, it was round the clock drinking in those days. I sometimes wonder, how are we still alive?
Don't know. I don't know, honestly. It's a mystery. I'll just read a bit of this to you. Drinking 6 glasses of wine a week could be good for your eyes. Scientists say in a study showing that moderate alcohol consumption is linked to a lower risk of needing cataract surgery. But like you say, you know, it must be minimal. But anyway, there we are. Talking about drinking, getting back to Easter for a while. I don't think you're old enough yet to remember, Leslie-Ann, when there were no newspapers on Good Friday. It's Good Friday today. The newspapers are here. But in the early part of my career, you got Maundy Thursday off because there were no papers on Friday. And what used to happen was I worked for the Express in both Manchester and London. And what you did is one year you got on the train in London and went to Manchester. And the following year you got on the train in Manchester and went to London on Maundy Thursday. And we organised a football match. And we used to play 2 15-minute halves each way. That's because, A, we were desperate to start the drinking and we couldn't start that until we got the football out of the way. But, B, we were also knackered, of course. Well, I wasn't. I was a very young man. I was still in my 20s, but most of them were in their sort of 40s and 50s. They couldn't run around for more than 10 minutes. And it always ended up in a mammoth, I mean absolutely mammoth, drinking session. And 3 or 4 of those who travelled either to Manchester or London never got back till the following Monday. You know, it was a huge fatality record in terms of drinking. And your dad will have been involved in that, you know.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I remember when I was a child, there was always this Maundy Thursday thing that my mum and dad used to get dressed up and off they'd go and meet all the my father's colleagues from the Mirror.
Right.
I guess it was the Daily Mirror at that point.
Yes.
And they always had an away day on Maundy Thursday. Mm-hmm. And they'd go off on a coach somewhere to, I don't know, Southend or somewhere.
Oh, lovely.
And they'd go to a fancy restaurant and they'd all get smacked up and then come back. And I remember it because my brother and my one sister I had then, I've got 2 now,
yes.
She wasn't yet born. We always used to get farmed out to the next door neighbours, Auntie Iris and Uncle Albert, as we called them. And we always had the same lunch as we had on Cup Final Day. It was known as Cup Final Dinner because they were
lovely.
From the north.
Yeah.
And it was a sort of stew with a crusty top on it, like a sort of crusty dumpling top. I don't know what it's called.
Yeah,
but we always used to have that on Cup Final Day and on Maundy Thursday.
Yes.
While my mum and dad went off and got pissed with the rest of my dad's colleagues.
Oh, that's great. I know what you mean about that crusty top pie. My mum used to make them. She used to call it suet pie. You know,
maybe like, it was that. Yeah, it was very nice.
Yeah.
I really loved it.
Lovely.
I looked forward to that so much.
Yeah, no, I bet you did. Okay, folks, you are listening to Life on Planet Porky on Good Friday. So very happy Easter to you all. Leslie-Ann, do you see a bit of light at the end of the tunnel now? A week on Monday. So it's Easter Monday coming up. A week on Monday, the pub garden's open. I'm going to spend a lot of that Easter Monday in pubs doing TV presentations for various shows. Taking the first pint in the English pub garden, which, as you will know, I'm looking forward to immensely.
I'm very happy for you, Michael. This has been a long wait, hasn't it? And
it has.
Your enthusiasm has been building by the second.
It
you
has.
Are so desperate. You're going to be first in the queue, aren't you?
Well, I'm going to try and take the first drink in a pub garden at 10 o'clock a week on Monday for a TV show. And that's the plan at the moment. Perhaps I shouldn't have said that because that might let the cat out of the bag. But I'm sure loads of people are going to try and do it as well. So it doesn't come as much of a surprise. Now, Leslie-Ann, you have very strong views on feminism and all that, which I entirely respect. One point we've talked about in this podcast before is Page 3 and the way, you know, it became antediluvian and it finally got wiped out and all that. But you know what? I wonder if these days, whether the women who still appear on Page 3 of some newspapers, but not fortunately naked anymore, which I think would be absurd and completely inappropriate. But I read the captions to the picture of the lady dressed, you know, in something very nice. And almost always the girl has been pictured because she happens to be the girlfriend of Real Madrid's goalkeeper, or the girlfriend of some actor who's just been given a part in a new blockbuster film. What I'm saying is the girls don't seem to be there on individual merit. They always seem to be there because of who their boyfriend is.
It's a very odd phenomenon, isn't it? And I think it's tired. It's had its day. It's time we abandoned this. It's, you know, it's one step away from all the online pornography, which has given rise to so much abuse of girls in our schools.
Oh, terrible story, that. Terrible.
I think we just need, if we mean this thing, if men in general mean that they respect women and they want equality, which a lot of men are saying, then this has to be abandoned. It's archaic. It has no place in our modern society.
No, I'm really rapidly approaching that thought myself, to be honest. I mean, you've got to remember, because page three was around forever in the newspaper industry, I just took it for granted that it was there, it was harmless, it was titillating to, you know...
Family show, titillating.
Oh, yeah. Come on, Miss Jones, you are a wordsmith. You know that titillating has nothing to do with a woman's bosom. It's a description of titillation, if you see what I mean.
Exactly. Yeah, well, I rest my case.
I think we'll move on. Right. Now, one of your favourite cities in the world is Paris, and it's one of my favourite cities in the world as well. So I was delighted to learn that only yesterday was the day in 1889, i.e. the, what was that, last day of March, 31st of March, that the Eiffel Tower was inaugurated by a bloke, believe it or not, called Eiffel.
Of course, because it was named after the architect.
Yes, Alexandre Gustave Eiffel, a civil engineer. But what I didn't know, because one of the other of my favourite monuments in the world is the Statue of Liberty, I didn't realise that Eiffel also built the Statue of Liberty on Liberty Island in New York Harbour.
Yeah, and there's a miniature one, isn't there, in on the Seine in Paris.
Oh,
a miniature Statue of Liberty, yes.
Oh,
he's actually Gustave Eiffel. And when I was at college in Paris years ago, we had a teacher who told us this amazing story about a woman who tried to commit suicide by jumping from the top of the, you know, you can go up to the, what they call the troisième étage, the third floor of the Eiffel Tower.
Right.
And he, this still makes me laugh. He drew this whole scenario. It was a major, major thing that happened in Paris at the time.
Right.
And he'd draw it on the blackboard with these little figures. And he'd go with the chalk, you know, voilà la Tour Eiffel. And then the voilà la jeune fille, the young girl who's about to jump off.
Yeah.
And there's a car driving around the bottom of the Eiffel Tower. Voilà la Citroën. And the Citroën has the soft top down. So the Citroën is open.
Yeah.
And he goes, voilà la jeune fille, elle est tombée. And she falls down off the top of the tower. Et la jupe de la jeune fille l'a sauvée. So her skirt goes up like an umbrella and brings her down like a parachute. And she lands in the back of this Citroën while this guy is driving on the road around the Eiffel Tower. I laughed so hard about that. I still laugh when I try and tell that story.
That's an incredible story. It's the reverse of the James Bond ejector seat. Instead of firing somebody out of your car, somebody drops in.
I know.
I hope the poor girl survived that injury and all that kind of stuff.
This is the worst part of the story. She survived, but she landed on the bloke who was driving the car and killed him.
Oh, no, but she landed on the head of the driver.
She landed on the drone. I mean, I suppose if you fall from the third floor of the Eiffel Tower, that's quite a drop, isn't it?
Well, I don't know. If the third floor is still fairly near the base, then, is it?
No. It's right the way. It's the highest one you can go up to.
I see. The viewing platform or something.
Yes. Yeah. Have you done that? Have you been up the Eiffel Tower?
No, I don't do those things. You know, I lived in New York for nearly 3 years, but I never went up the Empire State Building. It makes me feel like a tourist, and I prefer to see cities from a working point of view. You know, not sort of, you know, hauling yourself across town to the, art gallery called? The Loire, you know what I mean?
The Loire is a region in Paris. You mean probably the... The Louvre.
That's right. The Louvre. Yeah. Absolutely. So I don't really do those sort of things. I once had a theory about, it's funny you should say that, about her skirt blowing up and acting like a parachute, because I once expressed the theory that if you really wanted to make absolutely sure you were safe in an aeroplane, you should always wear your raincoat when you're sitting down. And I've got the theory that if you were blown out of an aeroplane, even at sort of 30,000 feet, your coat would fill with so much air, it would act as a parachute and bring you to Earth safely.
Pass.
What do you mean? Think about it.
Who sits in their airline seat wearing a raincoat?
Oh, that's what I mean. I mean, it's a bit impractical, but, you know, you could... I developed that theory into the idea that airlines could actually invent, you know, a paper-thin sort of suit to give you to wear when you got on. Instead of a sleeping suit, a shell suit, you'd have this thing made of, you know, very strong sort of plastic or something like that, and it would save you if the plane ever blew up and you were thrown out of the plane. I know it's a mad theory. So,
well, it is, because don't you think if the plane blew up that you'd be smashed to smithereens? There wouldn't be anything to float down.
Well, yeah, but you might just be one of the lucky ones who fell out the back of the plane or something. I mean, I think there are other problems.
That's so lucky to fall out the back of a plane, isn't
That's
it?
That's right, yeah. I think there are other problems, and that would be that you'd be able to breathe because there's no oxygen at 30,000 feet. You would probably freeze to death because it's about minus 60 at that height as well. So possibly not the brightest idea I've ever had. Now,
I think it's better just to have a massive big drink on the plane and, you know, take what comes.
I totally agree. By the way, did you know that when, you know, the standard procedure if a plane's going to crash is for the crew to say, put your head down between your knees. The only reason they say that is because pathologists have said in plane crashes, the only way you can identify the victims is by their dental record. So make sure their head isn't smashed up too badly so they can get their teeth out.
Oh, that's horrible.
Yeah, I know. But you know, I thought
it was kind of to protect your skull, protect your brain and stuff.
No, because it does exactly the opposite. It forces your skull into the seat in front, but at least your teeth would be safe from flying debris and all that kind of stuff, you see.
Oh, well, I won't do that next time then.
By the way, I've been watching a thing on Netflix called The Flight Attendant, and it is absolutely riveting. We had the conversation a couple of podcasts ago about how I always found flight attendants very attractive in their lovely uniforms and all that. But this is about a young woman who is completely dippy. That's the role that she plays, you know, this dippy flight attendant, always missing the bus to the airport and always late and often joining the Mile High Club, you know, on the plane with her because she runs the first class cabin. So she's not averse to a little rumpy pumpy with the odd billionaire or two. You know what I mean? But she wakes up in a hotel in Bangkok and the bloke who's picked her up off the plane, a businessman, is lying there with his throat cut.
And, oh, God. Yeah. Wasn't Bangkok going on the plane rather than when she landed?
Oh, Miss Jones, please. It was in Bangkok. For goodness sake, any opportunity to lower the tone of life on planet Porky after I worked so hard to maintain standards. I don't know. But anyway, what was I talking about that? I can't remember.
Sorry.
Yeah, see, giggling. Yeah. I'm not sure I got diverted. Anyway, it's fabulous. And she flees from Bangkok. She's back in America, but the police are closing in on her. It's very good if you get the chance. The flight attendant.
I saw the ad come up last night, actually. And, I tend to crash in front of the telly when I've had a really busy day. And I'm there with a glass of wine and the first thing I do is fall asleep, so I miss everything anyway.
Well, it's dangerous to fall asleep with a glass in your hand. You can spill it all over your carpets. There we are. Now, talking about women, and we have talked about a few women, do you know who Denise Coates is? She runs Bet365.
And she's got a lot of money. There's something very immoral about this, isn't there?
Well, I was going to ask you about that.
How can somebody make... I think she makes something like £57,000 an hour or some crazy figure.
1.3 million a day in the last financial
year.
It's
crazy. Yeah. Absolutely crazy. And didn't she get, I saw her holding up a gong. Didn't she get, not knighted, but damed or something?
Yes, you did. I think she got damed. And that's because she's given £88 million of her fortune to the Denise Coates Trust. Just for the benefit of our listeners, Denise Coates is the daughter of Peter Coates. Peter Coates was a small-time bookmaker in Stoke-on-Trent, where they grew up, and she turned three or four betting shops, which her dad run, into the world's biggest online betting site with enormous profits. Obviously, they own Stoke-on-Trent Football Club, now Stoke City, and her fortune is estimated at something, I don't know, about 16, no, no, about 8 billion. She's been paid 1.3 billion in just the last 4 years. Her money this year was 437 million. I mean, it's extraordinary. How can anybody sort of have control of that much money individually in this world?
Yeah, but not only that, you've become rich on other people's misery. Because
Have you? Is it misery?
I think it is. I think gambling is not to be encouraged. So many people have lost everything, including their homes, their partners, their jobs, their livelihoods, their families, because they've become addicted to gambling. Yeah. So this is somebody making a living on the back of other people's misery. I'm sorry.
Okay, I've got an alternative view. When I go to a football match, I love to fill in one of those forms. You know, you have to guess the correct score, first goal scorer, time of first goal, score at half time, score at full time. And I probably spend about, oh, I don't know, 30 quid filling that sheet in, £5 on six different boxes. And the thrill I get if I've got even one of them right, you know, the time of the first goal or the first goal scorer, and I go and pick up my money at the end, about £25 or something like that, you know, and I find it a real thrill and a real incitement. Also, I like betting on horses when I go to race meetings. The only horse races I bet on when I'm not at the race meeting, if I'm not there, is the Grand National and the Cheltenham Gold Cup and the Derby. But that's three times a year. But I enjoy the stimulation and the thrill of it. So why should you sort of start a campaign to ban reckless gambling when actually it forms a very, very small part of the gambling industry and those who enjoy having a bet?
Well, obviously, I'm not talking about somebody like you who has a little flutter. My dad used to, you know, but yeah. It was only ever small amounts at Cheltenham or whatever it was. But you do have people who become addicted to gambling.
People who become alcoholics. So we're going to ban drink.
Well, no, it's completely different, I think, because this does impact on families. There are many stories, aren't there,
yes. Of
people who are in the betting shop every single day.
Well,
and who can't stop, you know, especially that thing of when they're on a winning streak and they keep on and they keep on and they keep on and then they lose everything.
They can lose £100 in a few seconds. And I think those machines have got to be discouraged. You know what I mean? Where you're just pouring, and you're doing it on your credit card, by the way, so you don't even know how much you're losing. You know what I mean? And I think that should be curtailed without a shadow of a doubt. I recently got a notification from Peter Shilton, okay? And Peter Shilton has had problems with gambling in his past life. He's now campaigning against it. And in particular, the names of betting companies on the front of shirts. About, you know, one third of the clubs in this country are now sponsored by some form of betting company and all that. And Peter asked me if I would help him to endorse this proposal to get the names banned off the front of shirts. I wrote back to Peter because he sent me a text and said, "Hi, Pete." I said, "I'm actually not in agreement with you on this. I've got a different point of view. Would you like to come on my radio show, please? And I'll give you time and space to put your point of view forward and then I'll answer it." Peter didn't want to do it. So, you know, I would have put my point of view forward there.
Yeah, I understand. I've seen the publicity for this campaign that he's launched.
Yeah.
He was a victim himself, of course, so he does know what he's talking about.
Yeah. Your dad will have known Peter Shilton very well, won't he?
Yeah, and he's married to a very glamorous lady called Steph, who's a friend of mine on Facebook, actually. So,
really?
Yeah, so I see quite a bit of their publicity.
That's great. I tell you who else has had a birthday this week, Eric Clapton. He's 76. Now, am I right in thinking that Eric Clapton wasn't that bothered about writing songs? He was very much more bothered about playing the guitar. Is that right?
I think that's pretty true, yes. There was a famous story of when Jimi Hendrix first came to the UK and Eric was, you know, old slow hand. He was the big star. He was the one everybody wanted to see. And one night at a little club in the West End, which was, I believe, actually, in the basement of the university I went to, which is Westminster University.
Right.
Little club there. Eric Clapton was the star of the show. And at the end, this upstart came up to the stage and said, "Do you mind if I have a go?" Got on the stage with Eric Clapton's guitar and absolutely blew the place away. It was Jimi Hendrix.
Wow.
So even God has his gods.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, absolutely fabuloso. Now, Ms. Jones, we're well into this podcast, Life on Planet Porky, and we haven't mentioned John Lennon. So, for the benefit of our millions of listeners, we'd better put that right. Somebody wrote to a newspaper asking this question. Was John Lennon forced by a lawsuit to record an album? And the answer is a long, detailed story about a John Lennon album, which was called Sings the Great Rock and Roll Hits, but known as Roots. And it all went wrong. Phil Spector was producing it and the tapes got lost. And then the tapes appeared somewhere else and everybody was suing each other. That was the John Lennon LP, I'm afraid, which evaded me.
Yeah, no, it's absolutely a true story. And I think they've got some details wrong here because it was the rock and roll album. Yeah. And Phil Spector was indeed the producer. It did. It was the occasion when Phil Spector brought a gun into the studio and was waving it around. And John Lennon said at one point, "Phil, if you're going to shoot me with that thing, shoot me, but stop waving it around otherwise and let's get on with the job."
Yeah, that's right. I think I read a version of that in which he said, "Don't fire that gun in here, Phil. If you want to kill me, but I need my ears."
Yes. Yes, indeed. Yeah, it's a true story, but it was the rock and roll album. And it's the one with the picture of John on the cover, taken in Hamburg, standing in a doorway of an old building in Hamburg, was taken by a friend of his in the early 60s when the Beatles were doing their 10,000 hours in Hamburg. Hmm. And those pictures resurfaced. They were taken by a guy called Jörg Vollmer. Yes, along with Astrid Kirscher and the other guy whose name has just escaped me, which is Klaus Voormann. They were all friends with the Beatles in those early days, and those pictures resurfaced in New York in the 70s. Right. And John gave May Pang, who was his lover at the time, a bunch of money and said, "Go along and just buy any." It was a Beatles memorabilia convention.
Yes.
And she bought a few things. My friend Chris Charlesworth advised her what to look for, and she was on the lookout for these pictures, and they turned up.
Golly.
And they used one of those prints on the front of that rock and roll album.
Is that also the doorway in which you had your picture taken and appears on the back cover of your best-selling book, Who Killed John Lennon?
Exactly. That very doorway, yes.
Wow.
And the paperback version of that book is coming out in May.
Yeah, well, that's brilliant. Well done. Talking about superstars, by the way, and this is also a friend of yours. Sir Tim Rice reflects in Holy Week on the film commission that got away 50 years ago. The lyricist was asked to write the screenplay for the adaptation of his rock opera Jesus Christ Superstar, which he thought would be a breeze. "It was merely a question of my pointing out which spectacular visual effect accompanied which song," said Tim. "I set about this with great enthusiasm, and I was looking for a Ben Hur type budget to make it all work and make it great." He took it to the production company, who said, "Too expensive, can't afford it," and the job was given to Melvin Bragg.
Mm, how interesting. I haven't seen this. Where have you seen this story?
Oh, in one of those diaries somewhere, probably in the Times or something this week.
How interesting.
But there's not many things that Tim Rice has failed at, is there?
No, he doesn't fail. It's an interesting thing. We were having a conversation over lunch once, and I said to him, "Do you have any regrets?" And he said, "Yes, I wish I'd been Mick Jagger." And I said, "Yeah, but look at all your success. Look at all your achievements." And he goes, "Yeah, all I ever wanted to be was a rock star."
Yes. He was too tall to be a rock star, really, wasn't he?
I guess so. He is huge, yeah.
Yeah. Long John Baldry was about 6'6". And he always said that, you know, it just wasn't comfortable being that size on a stage, you know, with everybody else around. But anyway.
I mean, the ceiling's high on the stage. I don't see what the problem is there.
Neither do I. But then again, you know, I've never been lead singer with the Rolling Stones. Now, talking about superstars, by the way, there's another anniversary which we can talk about here over Easter, and that is the birth of Vincent van Gogh in 1853. I didn't realise that actually nobody had ever bought a van Gogh painting until after he died.
And he died in poverty, yes. This is a very important artist. He was the first artist to express mental health anguish in his paintings.
Yes, that's true.
And we know about this because of the thousands of letters he wrote to his brother Theo, which were collated in a book called Dear Theo.
Okay.
And I've read that book. It's fascinating. Mm-hmm. All about his struggles, Vincent's struggles with the darkness of his psycho-emotional landscape and all of that.
Yeah.
And, of course, he painted some of the most celebrated, influential art of all time. And it all depicted his own suffering, his paralyzing anxiety.
Yep.
There's a suggestion that he might have been bipolar, but of course there was no diagnosis in those days. Mm-hmm. But the letters are well worth a read as a background to those pictures.
It's just incredible that he's probably probably the world's most famous painter now, historically. Vincent van Gogh, and the guy who wrote American Pie wrote a song about him, Vincent, didn't he?
Don McLean.
No. Don McLean. Yes, you're absolutely right. Sorry, yeah. Don McLean. I thought you said John McLean then, and I was going to say...
Don.
I was going to say John McLean was the star of those Bruce Willis movies, The Cop, John McLean. Yeah, but you're absolutely right. Don McLean.
Starry, Starry Night.
Starry, Starry Night, yeah. Starry, Starry Night, paint your palette silver grey.
No, look out on us.
Sorry?
What? Blue and grey.
Oh, paint your palette blue and grey. Look out on a summer's day. Yeah, it was a great song. But to think that he died not knowing the recognition that was going to swamp over him in the next 100 years, it's just so unfortunate. It's like, you know, it's like we've mentioned him once already in this podcast. It's like John Lennon dying and nobody having ever heard one of his records until after he died. Do you know what I mean? It's so surreal.
It's pretty common, though, isn't it? I think in those days that kind of thing did happen regularly, because the worth of art was not really seen until after someone died. Of course, in the case of rock stars, you quite often get somebody like Michael Jackson will die, and their back catalogue is rediscovered by younger generations, and their albums outsell whatever they managed to achieve during their lifetime.
Yeah, no, it's absolutely incredible. Okay, Miss Jones, coming to near the end now, but just one more thing I had to mention to you. Also in this week, in 1991, Chesney Hawkes started a 5-week run at number one with The One and Only. Now, that was, I think, after you'd sort of, you know, finished writing about rock stars. But that's the only time the world's ever heard of Chesney Hawkes. The One and Only, 5 weeks at the top, never heard of again.
Yeah, one of the most famous one-hit wonders, wasn't he? His dad was a rock star, a bit of a rock star too, Chip Hawkes.
Chip Hawkes, he married a very beautiful blonde model. And I remember as a kid seeing a picture of the two of them moving into their new house in Surrey. And the most recent reference I've seen to Chip Hawkes was that he was answering allegations of sexual impropriety against young girls in the 70s, and he appeared at Chester Magistrates Court, my hometown, and he was cleared of all charges.
Oh, very good to hear.
Yeah.
He was in the Tremolos, wasn't he?
He was, yeah, that's right, yeah. Certainly you love me and my arms are open wide. Certainly you love me and I want you at my side. Yeah, you remember that one?
I'm sorry I'm so far away. Before we go...
I'm sorry, is that a lyric from the song, or are you just saying that you'd like to be far away from me when I'm singing? Huh?
No, not at all. Before we go, may I do a little shameless advertising here?
Please do.
If readers have nothing better to do on Saturday night, please tune in to BBC Two at 9 o'clock for a new series, the first of a new series called In 10 Pictures. The first episode is about Freddie Mercury, and I'm right there.
Oh, blimey, that's brilliant. Well, I'll be tuning in. So that's what, BBC Two, 9 o'clock Saturday night, yeah?
Yeah, yes.
Okay, that'll give me something to do.
Yours truly, talking about Freddie Mercury.
Lovely. Well, that'll be worth listening to because, of course, worth watching because, of course, you've written the best-selling book about Freddie Mercury. So you're truly an expert. Right, okay, Ms. Jones, have a great Easter weekend. And you and I will be back with our audience the day after Easter, Tuesday of next week. Until then, folks, thank you for listening to Planet Porky. Back with you very soon.
Happy Easter, everyone.
You've got to remember, because page three was around forever in the newspaper industry, I just took it for granted that it was there, it was harmless, it was titillating to, you know...
Family show, titillating.
Oh, yeah. No, come on, Miss Jones. Come on, Miss Jones, you are a wordsmith. You know that titillating has nothing to do with a woman's bosom. It's a description of titillation, if you see what I mean.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, well, I rest my case.
I think we'll move on. Airlines could actually invent, you know, a paper-thin sort of suit to give you to wear when you got on. Instead of a sleeping suit, a shell suit, you could have this thing made of, you know, very strong sort of plastic or something like that, and it would save you if the plane ever blew up and you were thrown out of the plane. I know it's a mad theory, so...
Well, it is, because don't you think if the plane blew up that you'd be smashed to smithereens, there wouldn't be anything to float down?
Well, yeah, but you might just be one of the lucky ones who fell out the back of the plane or something. I mean, I think there are other problems.
That's so lucky to fall out the back of a plane, isn't
it? That's right, yeah. I think there are other problems, and that would be that you wouldn't be able to breathe because there's no oxygen at 30,000 feet. You would probably freeze to death because it's about minus 60 at that height as well. So possibly not the brightest idea I've ever had. I bet you £50.
Okay, yeah. Done. Okay. Shake your hand, 50 quid.
Okay, all right, fine. No problem at all.